All right, welcome in, everybody. Fantasy Guru Podcast Series. Meet the staff. Today, we're going to find out and meet Tyler Beaker, one of the newest members here of the Elite Mafia and Fantasy Guru, Elite Fantasy, and EliteSportsBetting.com. I am Jeff Mance. Hopefully, you guys know that by now, at Jeff underscore Mance on Twitter. But Tyler Beaker, he is the star of the show today. Welcome, Tyler.
Thank you, Jeff. Super stoked to be here. Very excited to be working with Fantasy Guru, Elite Fantasy, and everything on the company brand. It's an honor to join, and I'm super excited to get this 2019 season underway.
Yeah, man. I'm pretty pumped up about it. So, Tyler, one of the newest staff, we've gone through and a lot of differences at Fantasy Guru. I mean, it's the same old site, same content you guys are used to, but we're getting newer, we're getting younger, we're getting fresher opinions. And I know Tyler and I will talk some Kyler Murray, that's for sure, in this podcast, and probably all summer. Should be an exciting time for sure. But first off, so one of them, when we were you and I started talking back, you know, during this process and trying to get you over here, the first thing is, like, how do you get Beaker out of the way you spell your name? How much is your last name mispronounced? Does anybody ever get it right?
No. The first time will be the first time. It's 100% pronounced incorrectly. Bucher, B-U-C-H-E-R, I've been told, is German for bookkeeper, like a librarian.
Okay.
I learned that from a high school German teacher. No one else has gotten anywhere close to phonetically pronouncing it, though.
Yeah, that's right. It is Beaker, right?
It is Beaker, yes, yes. And it's been an interesting childhood.
Even, I was going to say, dude, my name is the easiest. I have four letters, in both of my names, so it's one of the easiest. But I still get it, like, at a restaurant, Mons. And, you know, they'll always pronounce something different. So it's funny. So, yeah, I'm sure you're always going through that. And the bookkeeper is pretty interesting in German. That's interesting. So you took German in high school?
I did not, actually. I took years of Latin.
Latin? Yeah, I was going to say even worse.
Yeah.
Why Latin and not Spanish? Like, I took French, and to be honest, like, it was the biggest waste of time ever, but I took 4 years of it too. The only good thing to come out of it, I met my wife sophomore year in French class. That's the only good thing that came out of me taking 4 years of French. So why Latin over the other languages?
Well, for the longest time, I wanted to do something in the medical field, and having that Latin stem of where words come from, knowing the root of them, was the biggest draw to it. And ended up liking the class, liking the teacher, stuck with it for 4 years, and never made my way to medical school, though.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. Yet one of very few people in the fantasy industry that can say they longed for medicine or the thought of going into the medical field. But let's get into that a little bit. Growing up, so where are you from? Where did you grow up? Tell us about the young Tyler Beaker.
Yeah, so I grew up in central Pennsylvania in the Harrisburg area. Lived there, didn't move at all. Lived there my entire childhood growing up until college, where I went to Drexel in Philadelphia. So kind of stayed in that Pennsylvania area pretty much most of my life. I'm currently now living in Philadelphia as well. But most of my childhood was spent there in that central PA area growing up.
Central PA, how is that Amish or is that close to Amish? Where do you stand with the electricity?
we did have electricity. We were about an hour north of where the Amish kids played. Where I was pretty much divided right in half between Steelers fans, Eagles fans, and then, believe it or not, some Ravens fans as well in that kind of area.
Really? Ravens fans there? Why Ravens fans? Just, were they Colts back in the day or Browns fans? Or?
I guess it was just close to that Maryland border. I think that's the easiest, just geographically.
Okay, I guess so. I have to look that up on the map. That middle Pennsylvania, that's a huge state. So growing up, man, so tell us a little bit about, you know, you growing up and, like, were you into sports? You mentioned medicine. One thing I've learned about you quickly, I think most of our readers too, so you're pretty, compared to folks like me some of the dummies on staff, you're more intellectual. So you have that sort of edge about you. You're just smarter than most of us. So tell us about you growing up a little bit. What were your interests, hobbies, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I was always a hard worker in school, straight A's throughout. I guess my biggest classes were like math and physics, which kind of led me to getting my engineering degree. But growing up, I played sports year round, soccer 24/7, indoor, outdoor, travel, you name it. I was playing from an early age and continued playing all through high school, stopped at college, but that was my main thing. That we'd also play any kind of sport, though. I grew up with a really close-knit group of friends in like a cul-de-sac where not a lot of traffic came by, so we were able to play basketball, street hockey, you name it, inside the cul-de-sac. Growing up like that was awesome.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, that's a great – back in the day, I mean, you're a little – how old are you? You're 31.
I'm about to turn 30.
Oh, you're 30. Okay, I thought you were like a year or two older. But, yeah, so you're almost the big 3-0. So, you know, not necessarily a generation between us at all, but same thing for me growing up, that neighborhood aspect. And it seems like when you had a neighborhood – and everybody was into sports, it was just great. So you always got drafts. So where were you when you had drafts on the street corner? You're playing some street hockey. Were you the first pick? Were you the last pick in the middle? Were you captain?
Yeah, always the first pick or the captain, yeah.
Nice. Oh, look at you. It's
rush off my shoulders here, yeah.
There you go. Always the athletes. Are you still like – are you a runner? I figure like you're a gym guy hitting a treadmill a couple times a week. Are you that kind of guy still? You still after it or no?
Unfortunately, I did a lot of construction work following school. I went into Drexel getting my civil engineering degree, and a lot of the civil engineering work I did was construction related, being on site. And those projects, you work a lot of hours. There's not much time for the gym. So I'll say since I've started back here doing this fantasy work since the beginning of June, I've been able to go regularly, which has not been the case since college. But yeah, growing up though, I used to do long distance and track in the spring, cross country running, soccer, basically any kind of long endurance runs. Yeah, that was my niche for a while.
So you used to get after it, and yeah, it's funny because like Tyler and I joke about it on the side. Like most people starting out, and not necessarily starting out in the industry, you've been around a long time, so it's not like you're new by any means, but. Like just the workload, like Tyler came in like, hey man, I'm doing 15 things a day. This is what it's going on. And I'm like, oh, whoa, okay. This is great. But I actually very rarely do I have to like tell somebody pace, let's keep a good pace or whatever, because I'll be honest, like most of this industry, a lot of lazy people that want to do like one thing. And even that, it's like, oh God, you know what I mean? I hate to say it. We're fortunate that at our group, not that many outside of Tommy G are that lazy. So we're good like that. And I think Tyler is one of those guys that is inspiring some of the staff, because I've noticed some guys pick it up even since you've come over, which is pretty fascinating. Do you find that with the fantasy industry, like from the outside looking in, did you always think like, why aren't these guys doing more? I don't get it. That's all they do for a living. Because you've had other jobs while working in fantasy, right?
Yeah, and it's tough working that full – I'd probably do about 12 to 13 at the full-time day job, come back home, work for another 6-plus hours, maybe get 5 hours of sleep, and then rinse and repeat during the NFL season. So it's a grind for when you're working a full-time job and trying to do this analysis after your work. I know some people are able to do it at their daytime jobs. I was never really blessed with that opportunity. But if you're able to do that, good for you. But, yeah, I mean – I'm so blessed that you gave me this job. Like, I'm not trying to suck up to you right now, but like,
no.
I just want to make sure you never regret that choice. And that's why I'm coming out hot and heavy with trying to do at least 10 or so articles a week, 2 a day. I figure that's an easy baseline to start, and hopefully keep it going into the regular season.
And the thing, so people understand, like, I will never say I gave you this job and I gave Armando the job. I think you two of you specifically, Russ has been with us a while, but like, you guys took it. You did the work. You know, that's what we're going for. And I hope the folks out there listening, and those of you who are over at fantasyguru.com, Elite Fantasy, and Elite Sports Betting, understand it's really what we're about now. You know, whatever we understand the perception in the industry, you know, because we've been successful, that people say, oh, you guys are just hot shots and screenshots and all that stuff. And maybe, you know, a portion of that's deserved, but bringing you in, bringing Armando, like myself, everything you say about working 12-hour job and then coming home and doing this work is what I did from like 05 to 2010. You know what I mean? For like 5, 6, 7 years before I got full-time in the industry too. And, you know, we took that opportunity and you took this opportunity and we're going to be here working around the clock for our subs, for our people. So it's definitely not me giving you the opportunity. It's you taking it and you doing great work that got you the opportunity. Same with Armando and Russ and everybody else. So just want to make that clear to you and to everybody out there that like, this is, when you work hard, it's just like you guys with your fantasy teams, when you're busting your tail constantly and, you know, kids go to sleep and girlfriend leaves and then you hit the stats and you hit the pages and you're trying to find lineups and trades and all the stuff. That extra work is what gives you the championship. It's not, hey, you know, I got lucky and made this trade. It's you grinded and got after it. So I'm a big believer, Tyler, and hard work pays off, and you're an example of that.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, I've been doing this, I think, since like 2013, 2014. Mm-hmm. You want to dive into that part a little bit, how I got started there?
Yeah, man. I'm into – well, let's go back a little bit. We'll backtrack a little bit. So you're playing soccer. Was soccer your sport growing up? Like, what was your sport
yes,
growing up?
Yes, definitely.
One. Yeah.
Yeah. Soccer was the main one. Like I said, played year-round, traveled. I was lucky enough when I was a freshman where I got to jump up to the JV league and skip the freshman team entirely. And then
so you're
I just
kind
of – yeah, I was good back in the day. I'll say that.
What did you play? Were you forward, defense?
I was mainly a shutdown defender. We had a really, really good group of guys that would not allow many goals. It was a lot of fun playing with them, shutting down all these kids that would try to come up to you and, like, make these fancy moves with their legs and step overs and crosses. And you just – shutting them down was the best feeling in the world.
Dude, I swear to God, I'm a strong believer in, like, just inherent qualities about people and talent. Some people are just born with certain things that they're going to do well or something they – you know, and it's usually something you're interested in. Playing defense – in any sport, basketball, football, baseball, whatever, it's an effort item. You have to give max effort. You know, defense is not easy. It's the hardest position to play almost all the time, and it's the one that's less interesting because you get the less amount of credit. So you have to be willing to work and sacrifice and take be proud of yourself for a job well done because you're never going to be given the praise you deserve. Would you agree? Disagree?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's an unappreciated position, but definitely one that – it's a team effort. I mean, your offense wouldn't succeed without a defense. The two definitely go hand in hand. And I'll say we had a lot of fun doing indoor soccer where it's a much more condensed field. You could bounce the balls off the walls. My brother and I, he's a year and a half younger than me, but we were close enough sometimes where we'd play on the same teams. And we became known as the Beaker Bash Bros.
Yeah. Where
we'd normally lead our teams in yellow cards, red cards, and goals scored for. Because when you're playing on such a short field in indoor soccer, you can score from anywhere on the field. That was a lot of fun. Those were some good memories.
The only soccer I ever played on a team with was indoor soccer. Back in the day, I played 2 years of indoor soccer, and I found it a lot more fun. For sure. I like the short fields. I like being able to knock it around. But you're right. There's a lot, especially when you're a defender. You're trying to clear it and it just comes back at you. It bumps off somebody, and next thing you know, it gets past the keeper. And so it's fun. I like the indoor variety for sure. Where were you? Did you play baseball growing up? Did you play any football growing up? Where were you with football, the American version, at least growing up?
I was not allowed to play. My mom was a pretty overprotective. And the irony of it was my brother and I were the bash bros of soccer. So we just found our other outlet to take our physical frustration out on it. It was a lot of fun, though. But I didn't play any football at all growing up. My biggest exposure to it was Madden 04 with Michael Vick on the cover, and yes. I'm one of those Madden generation kids where that's where I got my football fix.
Learn the game that way, and smart. I mean, yeah, my parents never knew what the hell I was doing. I'm the youngest of five. So, like, we played football just everywhere and tackled, and just you have to have that gene. Like, you have to – it's a Neanderthal gene. If you don't have it, like, football at a – maybe, you know, when we're kids, it's fine. But you get to, like, 13, you're like, what the hell am I doing? And, yeah, I just felt you're way too smart for that. You're way better off, breaking down the numbers and everything else to just get your teeth kicked in for no reason or get your arm broken on the concrete like me as a kid. And my son is like that. My son played 2 years of football and only flag football. Actually, he didn't play tackle, and it's too much. Like, there's just no way for him to do it. He's just – you know, likes the game, he loves the game, but it's, you know, as a parent, you have to make that decision at some point, and we made it, and your mom was probably good for doing that. Saved you some brain cells, that's for sure. So were you a fan growing up? When, you know, I know you're in Philly now, were you an Eagles fan? Were you a Steelers fan? What fandom did you attach yourself to?
So it was weird. Like, my family wasn't that into sports growing up, so I just kind of became a Falcons fan just from that Madden 04 version.
Oh, really? So that's okay.
Really, that was the catalyst that got me into football, and franchise mode with the Falcons, that was my go-to for decades, it feels like now. But yeah, I've always been a Falcons fan. Eventually, once I moved to Philly to Drexel for college, I became a Philadelphia fan by default. It's kind of hard to live here and not just get enwrapped with everything. My sophomore year was the year the Phillies won the 08 World Series.
Nice.
And that year, like, it just – everything clicked where I just became a Philly fan for everything. Like,
yeah,
I was definitely a bandwagon fan. Like, I'd never watched baseball before, but I was fun with watching baseball with guys that were actually into it. Their enthusiasm rubbed off on me. I actually got into the sport for once. Yeah, that's how I've kind of gotten into sports as far as, like, watching it. And I guess football, the beginnings of that as well.
Yeah. So are you you're still a Falcon fan though, over the Eagles?
No, I've kind of transitioned into an Eagles fan now.
You have, huh? Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. There weren't many roots there except for an 04 Madden PlayStation 2 disc. So there wasn't a lot of, like, for me to hang on to. So I just went with a group of guys living in the Philly area. And
all right. So you're currently an Eagles fan.
Yes.
Sorry, well, you made the right choice. One blew a 28-point lead or 25-point lead in the Super Bowl. The other beat the Patriots. So I think you chose wisely with that. You mentioned baseball. Now, I see you playing – I see you talking DFS baseball every now and then. How do you play daily baseball? Are you still somewhat of a fan? I mean, the Phillies signed Bryce Harper. Things are going well so far this season. Are you still baseball fan or just when things are hot?
I'd say I'm more of a baseball DFS fan where I kind of just play like 1 to 3 lineups a night. I took like 2 or 3 years off, but this is my first year getting back into it. And I've had some good success in the month of May. June's been kind of iffy here and there, but that's been what's really rekindled my interest in baseball has been the ability to play DFS. I think a lot of people can relate to that.
No doubt about it. I think there are a lot of people that, you know, and that it's like that, especially. I have a theory that the worse your sports town is, the more you gravitate towards fantasy and daily. You know what I mean? Because when teams are, if you're in Boston nowadays, it's like, whatever, we're winning everything and every sport, doesn't matter. When you're in like Milwaukee, even though Bucks had a good year and the Brewers are doing well, you know, you haven't won anything forever, so you're like, screw it. I want to look at these other players and these other super teams. I'll be a Warriors fan. I'll be a Yankees fan or something, or even a Phillies fan or a Cub fan because you're close or something. So there's something to that, I think, with the worse the sports town or the cruddier your teams are, the more you get into sort of fantasy where you can embrace everybody.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. That makes a ton of sense. Instead of trying to root for guys that are bad, find the ones you like and enjoy watching.
I know, man. I have, like, you'll hear, I go on rampages about ownership and teams and things like that. Like, I'm starting to get really into the political side of sports where, charging fans more, The amount of tax money and grants that is given to organizations to build new stadiums for no reason. Atlanta got a new stadium. Texas, the Rangers are getting new stadium. Out here in Arizona, where I reside, they want to redo Chase Field. Chase Field's one of the most glorious stadiums I've ever been to. I've been to 22 major league stadiums out of 30. And it's like, it's easily a top six stadium. And they're like demanding all this. Like, why? You don't, you know, it's just, it's starting to really bum me out as a fan that, you know, certain cities and certain teams won't be competitive, but want to keep charging more and more and more and more for that. And yet we feel this fascination having to stay a fan. We have to be a Kansas City fan. We have, cause we grew up there. We have to be a Dallas fan, cause we grew up there. We have to be a Philly fan or a Chicago fan or a Bay Area fan, all because we have allegiance. We stuck with our team. We continue to support them, but they don't show it back. And that pisses me off, man.
Yeah, I can definitely tell. I'm not as heated about that as you are, but I get it.
That
money definitely adds up.
It does, and it's just nonsense to me, but nevertheless. So, all right, so your parents aren't that into sports growing up. You are. You're playing with the kids in the neighborhood. You're bash-broing it with soccer. You know, as you get older, I mean, you're intellectual, obviously, straight-A student. So as you get into, like, high school and college, like, what would the high school Tyler Beaker think he'd be doing at age 30? Like, where did you see yourself? What was the plan going into it? You know what I mean?
My forte. Yeah.
Repeat that real quick.
I think it was a Discovery Channel.
Hey, if
math is definitely my forte going into.
So you're into math.
Is it cutting out?
Yeah, it's cutting out a little bit. It's okay. We're okay here. But I think it just got a little staticky for a second. But repeat that for us in case we missed it. So high school Tyler Beaker thought what? You're into math. What would you plan on being?
Yeah, math and physics were definitely my forte. I remember as a kid, I watched a Discovery Channel how-to on the Arizona Cardinals were building their new retractable field underneath the stadium that rolled in and out.
Yeah, the grass, yeah.
Yeah, and I was floored by the how-to of, like, how could that happen? How do they do this? Like, the physics behind it and the mechanics behind it absolutely floored me, and that's what drew my interest into becoming an engineer. When you're 17, 18 years old, you have no idea what you want to do for life. So you take the information given to you. Okay, I'm good at math. I'm good at physics. And then try to make a guess on what you want to do from there. I took a lot of medical, not like interviews, but like kind of like shadowing classes where I was able to like see what it was like to work a day in the medical field. I looked at all the additional schooling I would have had to have done. And I kind of just ruled that out right away. So that's how I ended up in the engineering degree. Like I said, you're not really given much information as a 17-year-old to make. And then you have to go apply for all of these different student loans, get yourself in mountains and mountains of debt. And maybe when you come out on the other side of 4 years or so of college that you like the job you're in. Turns out, it kind of was middle of the road for me.
Yeah.
Not many people are willing to like invest a lot of money into an engineering degree and then just kind of back out on it. But
right.
I started writing as a part-time writer, like maybe like 2 years into work. Like I'd come home from work and it was the same routine. I'd like come home, cook, and then maybe play some video games. Like there's gotta be more to life than this. So I started like reading a lot more sports articles online, and one of the sites was like, I think it was a fan-sided site for the Eagles, Inside the Eagles. And I applied there to work. I saw some of the articles were okay. Right. So I basically viewed it as an opportunity for me to go in there and write better content. So that's how I got my first leg in the door in the writing industry was
nice.
Actually working for an Eagles website.
When did you think you're going to, like writing, for instance, like you're a good writer. Did you know you had that ability? Were you into it in high school and college? Did you always do well on essays? Like You know, when did you realize, hey, this is something I kind of enjoy or that you're good at?
Yeah, I always took like advanced classes in high school, and English was no different. It wasn't anything I was particularly good at, though. It was mm-hmm. just get a B plus here in this class or whatever. Right. Writing was never anything I looked forward to doing. I never anticipated myself finding myself in this kind of field, but I guess after working with numbers for 5+ years in college, I did a 5-year degree at Drexel. Words just came a lot more easier after all the numbers.
Yeah, I bet. So you're in the routine. So you get a job out of college and you're doing civil engineering at that point, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. So then you're doing engineering at that point, the routine's kind of blah. And are you still like in college and then right after, are you still following sports? I mean, you mentioned the Phillies championship in 08. Are you still, you know, what's your sports intake on a daily basis at that point before you decide to go work for FanSided?
Kind of like just a normal college routine where, sports are on, have some beers and watch it with the guys. It wasn't like anything crazy. I wasn't super statistically obsessed. I didn't even play fantasy football until my first year in college. We'd use it as a way to keep in touch with my high school buddies. And that league only lasted 1 year and then fell apart.
Really? What year is that? Is that that's your first fantasy football year?
Correct. Yeah, that would have been 2008.
Okay, so 08, first year playing fantasy football, and 1 year and then it disbanded. Were you into it? Had you heard about it before that and just never played? Or was that the first time you heard about fantasy sports?
Yeah, that was the first time I heard about it, and I was invited from one of my best friends. He was closer with the group than I was, but we all went to the same school together, so we all knew each other. We just wanted to use it as a way to keep in touch after school, and I got my ass handed to me.
Did you really?
I was terrible at it.
Awesome.
I looked back at the draft, I think, a year ago, and I think I took a quarterback in the first round.
Okay, yeah.
I know I finished dead last.
Ooh.
I love it. And that's the best way to learn is by making mistakes and dusting yourself off and getting back on the pony.
Dude, I'm telling you, it really is too. And that's really good advice for those of you out there. Maybe, you know, you're coming up or what have you. You got to learn from those mistakes. There's all these quotes you hear and see people post on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. And like, there is no such thing as losing, only lessons learned and things like that. And it's really that's one of them that's really true. Because if you lose in whatever it is, I don't care if it's any kind of competition or even you didn't get a promotion, you didn't get a job, this happens, something negative happens. If you're just going to sulk and sit there and like, you're destined for failure. You're going to repeat it. Never going to break out of that routine. You got to find out why. What did I do? What's wrong? You know, people sometimes always want to say it's just a luck thing. And honestly, Tyler, like that's the way I grew up, and I blast my parents for this all the time. It was always like, oh, it's just bad luck. We have bad luck. We have bad luck. And I grew up youngest of five, hating it. I never want to hear about bad luck again. I want to just break through. Just keep working. There's this no bad luck. Yes, things are bad to everybody, but keep going. Keep working. Don't wait for good luck because that magical day is never going to come. You know what I mean? So, I don't care where you finish in your leagues last year, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, whatever. We're all getting better here. I'm getting better every day. Tyler's getting better every day. You guys listen, ideally, hopefully are getting better every day. And that's sort of what we're all here for. So I think there's a good lesson in that. So did you take that year off then from 08, then the league disbanded? Did you keep playing or did you wait a couple more years?
No, the league just disbanded. I started playing with a bunch of guys in my fraternity instead. And I learned quickly how valuable targets are. I'll say that. That was the biggest change in my offensive, the biggest change from year one to year two was seeking out how important targets were in terms of offensive opportunity. That's essentially the word I'm looking for here. How much opportunity a player had was integral to how many fantasy points they could accrue. That's what made me have a huge, I went from an 8-person league with my home team to a, I think it was a 12 or 14 with this year two group and made it to the championship and lost. But just finding what was important was a huge step in me finding out how much I loved fantasy football.
Yeah, and that, I think that's fascinating too, because when you talk about 08 and all that, obviously I'm an old man here. And I started playing in 89. And when I started playing fantasy football and all through the 90s, it was like running backs, like targets weren't even a thing. It wasn't even a stat. I mean, it didn't even exist. You didn't even know what they were. So, you know, people my age, 40 years old and older, they're just, you know, we are so used to running backs only, and for different reasons. Nowadays, it's how many, you know, catches, how many targets do running backs get, catching the ball in the backfield. Back then, there was like Roger Craig. That's it. Anybody in a Bill Walsh offense, they would catch the ball. Really, no other running backs caught very much. Peyton did, but that was, you know, before that, before 89 even. You know what I mean? So it's a different game today than it was even 10, 15 years ago. Right? I mean, passing, it's so pass heavy. You mentioned quarterbacks and you drafted a quarterback in the first round. I mean, you wouldn't think of doing that today, no matter what Patrick Mahomes does, right?
Right. No. I even see him going in the first four rounds and I'm still flabbergasted that that occurs, but I'm very happy to see where the masses have gone from that first, second round must grab a quarterback down to at least maybe the fourth, fifth round. We're slowly making progress to where quarterbacks should be drafted. And that's really only happened over the last maybe 3 or so years.
Yeah, it really has. And it's still a mistake a lot of people make, and, you know, something that and the reason being, folks, those of you just listening here and trying to get something out of this one, is the difference between quarterback one and quarterback six. It could be very, very small. Some years there'll be a huge jump, but Patrick Mahomes was, nobody thought he was going to be the number one quarterback last year. He was, I think, 14th off the board on average last year. Andrew Luck, nobody thought any, you know, anything of him. These are the top two quarterbacks going into this year. You know, and every and the year before, as a moderate Falcon fan, Carson Wentz fan too, Tyler probably knows that, going into – Cam Newton was the be-all, end-all going into 2016, and he failed, and Matt Ryan rose. And then Matt Ryan was the be-all, end-all, hottest quarterback in the world going into 2017, and then it turned out to be Carson Wentz. And then Carson Wentz, of course, you know, got injured before the Super Bowl. But, you know, and it's just sort of – I see people chasing those quarterbacks year in and year out, Tyler, and it's never really works out. Where the guy who was so hot last year is the hottest guy the next year.
Yeah, and a lot of reasons why they normally become the highest scoring fantasy players because of their ridiculous touchdown rates. I think Wentz had like a 9.5% touchdown rate when it was sophomore year. Matt Ryan had something above that as well. I mean, most of these guys have like I think the league averages were right around 5.0%. So when you see guys nearly doubling that, like Deshaun Watson did his rookie year, it's just really unsustainable.
It's
screaming regression, and that's when these quarterbacks fly off the board at the third or fourth round turn or something like that. And you can just sit back and wait until the 12th, 13th. Heck, in my home league, I normally wait until the very last round to grab my quarterback, and it's brought me a lot of success.
So where do you stand? And I agree with that. By the way, a true story from 3 years ago, 2016, whatever, 3 years ago. I did zero quarterback, kind of, and I didn't mean to do it, just kind of the way the draft, in an FFPC, Fantasy Football Players Championship League. And so I waited the last two rounds to get my quarterbacks. And my next to last pick, I was high on him. I'll put my hand up. Brock Osweiler. Going to the Texans that year after the Super Bowl, the Broncos, $70 million. I loved DeAndre Hopkins. So I, like, Osweiler was my guy. I think it was the 19th round I chose, right? 20th round, the guy I got, Matt Ryan. So like, my idea was the extreme bad and the extreme good of it all, and it worked out very well. Won that league that year. So, you know, a pretty big payout as well. So it's like, you know, the theory works even when you miss terribly on that first pick. Maybe the second guy, if you choose wisely – and, you know, you look at the terms of the offense and how well they do, you can get that second guy to go off. So, waiting definitely works on that. Going back a little bit here, so you're playing in some fantasy football leagues, 2008 and onward. And do you play any fantasy baseball? Do you start hearing about DFS? I know you're big into DFS, and obviously we'll be seeing you at elitefantasy.com. But, when did you start hearing about that?
Well, that I think I was a little late to the party with. I think I started hearing about it in 2013, 14, and then maybe in the 2015 season is when I finally decided, let's give it a try. One of my friends that I kind of respected was like, okay, this guy didn't lose all of his money in the first day he did it, so let me give it a shot. I doubled my money week one. Week two, I lost my money. Week three, I got first place in a GPP.
Wow.
So since then, I've just been ecstatic about DFS. And I was like, how did I luck my way into this? How did I beat 57,500 people to get first place? And I've been trying to unlock the keys to that ever since.
I know, right?
A $2 bet.
Really? You won a $2 GPP. How much was the take on that?
10K to first.
10K. That's pretty awesome. It is. It's always a struggle, man. Having that kind of success early on, especially, how hard is it for you even now? Was that 2015 you said? So like 4 years later.
Right.
How is that not chasing that? Is that still your biggest win?
Yeah. In a one day. Yeah. 10K still is. It's been difficult trying to chase first place in tournaments. You can do it in some smaller fields, but not in like the tens of thousands of fields. Those are tough to win. A lot of people refer to them as lottery tickets, and I still play it because I still think there's still a chance for those one in 50,000 whatever odds for you to come through and win.
Yeah, that's pretty fun. Well, let's get back to that in a second. I want to hear about – so when did you first find out there was an actual industry – like people that did this for a job? So you're starting to play 08 and whatnot. And so, and was it 2010 you said you started writing for FanSided? Was that the timeline?
Let me see. It was 2014 actually when I started writing for them.
Oh, okay. So when did you first realize that this even existed? Like that there was an industry of fantasy on the fantasy side of things?
Yeah, it must have been that 14 season. I remember I got super into Football Guys and listening to Sigmund Bloom's podcast that he would do. And he was kind of my intro way into the analytics side of football. I'm pretty sure a lot of people can relate to that as well. I know Football Guys has been around for a very long time, and they were my intro into the deeper learning of fantasy football.
Yeah. And again, been around a long, long time. Sigmund Bloom's done a great job, obviously. And, that's the thing. There's such a level of respect I have personally for those folks that, because they were around when I was coming up. We're talking 2005 on up, really, I think. Yeah, 2005. Yeah, it's a long time. But, for folks to do it, I don't think people realize how difficult it is to keep going, keep innovating, keep grinding, through big wins. And big wins, anybody could be into it. It's the big, like when you do a $2 DFS and you win $10K, you're going to be way into it. It's you learn when you throw that $100 into a GPP with only 200 people and you fall flat. That's when you know what you're made of, because that's the not fun part of it, right?
Right, right. I'm not a big dollar entry kind of player. I normally like to attack single entry tournaments and three max. That's where I kind of find my sweet spot, is where I find the most success. But I do a lot of good work in the preseason. It's kind of easy for me to clean up there. And even I think my biggest entry was like a 5-5-5 or maybe a 3-3-3. Mm-hmm. And I've never sweat more than that entry. And I was two spots into the green. Like, I barely cashed in that, and I was so nervous just to get my money back.
But that's wild. I can't wait for your preseason DFS stuff over at Elite Fantasy too, man. It's going to be awesome. It's when you know these players and you scouted them and written about them for months and months, and then you know sort of the tendencies of these teams and they're playing, you know, how they take on the preseason, the edge is just dramatic. It's dramatic. So I'm anxious for that. So you learn about the industry sort of in 2014 and start, you know, figuring that out. So talk a little bit about that first job. So you're on Fansided, you'd apply for the job, and I assume you get it, right?
Yes, yeah. And it was the first job where I had to come up with my own content and to come up with my own content on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. So I was basically dipping my toes into the water, trying to find a new kind of angle on how to write about the Eagles during the offseason. I wrote about them in their NFC East conquest, their offseason additions, you know, that kind of stuff. And then by the end of the season, I realized that I'm writing about just one NFL team. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather write about all of them and in a fantasy capacity instead of just a zoomed in, not like beat reporter, but you know what I mean? With those Fansided sites. Yeah. So I decided to instead switch to the fantasy angle, and I applied for NumberFire, and JJ Zacharyson brought me on board. Ended up working there with a lot of good people. And that's where I got my start in the fantasy industry was, I guess, learning a lot from how Sigmund Bloom and the football guys did things and bringing my own aspect and my own twist of it to the NumberFire website.
That's JJ and I are actually overdue for our annual handcuffing versus non-handcuffing debate. We do it every single year on Twitter. We go at each other a little bit about both sides of that. I'm happy to say I've been on the winning side of that pretty clearly over the last couple of years, though he had me a few years ago, I think down and out for a couple of years. But I'm big into handcuffing. I'm just it's one thing, my personal background, and Tyler, you and I have talked about this, but I know systems, you know, growing up playing football and all this. Like I know what the goals are for a certain offense, and right, wrong, or indifferent, in my world, these guys aren't just robots that will perform. They need the opportunity to perform, and I'll take a fourth string running back who gets an opportunity in offense A versus the starter in offense B. You know what I mean? So I've been on that handcuffing kick for a long, long time. And JJ and I always go back and forth with that. And I'll bring him on the show on the SiriusXM show for a roundtable. But love what JJ does. And NumberFire does a great job as well. So you're working NumberFire. Where else? I know you were at Pro Football Focus there as well. I want to go back to Fansite. So I hope you can say this and don't feel ashamed if you can't. What was your first payday in the industry?
Not with Fansided. Not with NumberFire for a while. A lot of people are trying to get in this industry, and you have to realize that not everyone's offering paying jobs. This job is this gig, this industry is one based on meritocracy, and you have to work for it. It took me, I don't think I got paid until maybe my second or third year writing for fantasy. And some of it was based on per page views. Some of it was based on just a per article thing. It varies site to site. And I'll just say I think now you probably have an easier chance to get paid for it, but there's just a lot more competition to get in there.
Sure. Did you just drop meritocracy, by the way? Like, dude, that is an absolute first for the Fantasy Football League podcast. Dude, welcome Tyler Baker to the house, everybody. Meritocracy, what, it's such a great word, and it's so true about the industry too. It's just what this is. I mean, there are no jobs, like other places you can go and apply. And I think that's, people think that, like, hey, I can go and they're, hey, we have four positions available and this is what they pay. No, none of that is true. Everything you do in this industry is based on, you know, the amount of work you've done, how well it's been received, how well it sells in a lot of capacities. You know, I mean, the business side of this industry is something else. And it's honestly been something that's been held back for a long time because they don't pay anybody. I remember my first paying job was $25 a month. Like, that's what I got paid. And I was thrilled that I actually got paid, because like you, spent years doing it all for free. And, you know, there's sort of the chicken and the egg theory where you're paying somebody what they're worth and paying somebody a little bit more will lead to better work, hopefully, because I think the business side of fantasy sports industry has been held back for a long time. A lot of people looked at this like it was a part-time gig, even business owners, you know. And that's sort of when I came up in the industry, it was even the bigger, so-called bigger companies that treated this thing like it's, hey, it's just my, you know, pet project or whatever. And even though they were growing in size, they weren't willing to put in the work behind the scenes, invest money that they were making into the business side, create new things, stay on top of everything. And thus, a lot of those companies back from when I started 05 through 2010, that they're out of business now. And, you know, it's pretty fascinating, though, that you attach yourself to ones that have stayed in business and stayed around and stayed relevant, you know, from football guys to, you know, Fanside, I know, got sold, but NumberFire also got sold to FanDuel and all that stuff. But, and then PFF, of course, pretty fascinating. So what was that first paycheck for you then? Like, when you actually got paid, was it, did you get like 20 bucks? Did you get 100 bucks a month? Like, how bad was it?
Something like that. I basically just viewed it as extra beer money. Yeah. It was nothing to write home about. But it was kind of cool just to see, like, all this hard work. Okay, I got a little payout out of it. That's nice. I've been at it for 2 to 3 years. This is a nice little kickback. Because sure. I know, like, everyone that I worked for, like, the bosses like JJ, and when I also started at RotoViz a long time ago as well, they were all going to bat for us to try to get the writers paid. And it wasn't their call at all. And I just always appreciated that the chief content officers would always try to go to bat for the writers to try to get them paid. And it, for the longest time, it wasn't a paying industry. You just kind of had to keep grinding. Just keep, like, my goal was just to keep putting out content and hopefully something would happen. I, for the longest time, I was writing for NumberFire and RotoViz, and then I started writing for Fantasy Labs for a while. Nice. And then I applied for a full-time job with PFF. Saw that their fantasy department was offering an opening. Actually, I think they were offering 3 openings at the time, but they got cut budget-wise and it got slimmed down to 1. And they could only take on 1 person. But they offered me a part-time job, and I've been a big fan of PFF statistics and tracking. I know people love to bash them, but I've been a big fan of how they utilize all the information they collect for a long time, and I was ecstatic to get even just a part-time offer for them. So I ended up dropping all the other side jobs where I'd write like an article or two here, there, and just do solely PFF for the last 2 seasons.
That's and by the way, anybody, people love to bash anything that's successful, and like PFF is fantastic. We're always partners with them, from, you know, Mike Clay and now Jeff Ratcliffe and what they've done. I mean, a true story about PFF, back in like 06, 07, I started developing my own rating system for corners, right? I've always been into the defense side of the ball and linebackers, defensive line, and specifically at corners and coverages. And I started developing my own rating system, and I evolved. I've watched every game since 99, every second of every game. So I have my own charts, and I still do it to this day. But like, I would do this. I thought, okay, and I was posted on Scout Fantasy Football at the time, the site me and Ted Schuster owned. And then I came across PFF, and I said, oh, they have this, and they're pretty damn good at this. And I'm like, well, I guess I don't really need to do this anymore. So I still do my own charting and all that, but I use PFF religiously and believe in what they do. You could agree or disagree with some of the rating systems and measurements, and that's fair, all fair, but anybody who knocks them is just out of their minds, because they do great work. I love the fact that you get stuff on offensive lines, corners, things that truly impact those skill positions.
I hate the idea that people look at fantasy football like a running back or quarterback, just a robot that's going to do whatever they're going to do. That may be true in baseball. It's just not true in football. It's not the way it works, unfortunately. So, yeah, man, there's too much of that. Anything that's successful always – we've dealt with it. Like I told you, you know, during the interview process and stuff, I said, listen, man, are you up for it? Because we get bashed a lot because we've been successful the last few years, you know, and we wear the black hats. People love to rip on us anytime we're wrong about something or what have you, but that's not going to get in our way. You know, we're going to still do what we do and not scared to be wrong ever. So I think that's fascinating back to the PFF stuff. So anyway, so you're working there. So, you talk about training ground, Rotovit, number fire, PFF. Like, dude, your pedigree couldn't – do you realize, like, you couldn't have a better pedigree?
I did not at the time, but I've always enjoyed writing for these sites when I was there. And like you mentioned a few minutes ago, that a lot of companies had folded around the 2015-2016 season. These guys have been – big time producers. I still read their content to this day.
Sure. Yeah, man. Absolutely.
it's actually funny that you even dove into the cornerback charting. For the longest time, a long time ago, I tried to figure out a way that I could differentiate myself from other writers in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you're aware of NFL.com. He now works with Yahoo. Matt Harmon and his reception perception.
Yep. Absolutely.
I actually reached out to him to see if I could offer a complimentary piece called Deflection Perception, where I spent an entire summer tracking cornerbacks, routes run, routes defended, what success they had against each route. So I can definitely relate to you doing that as well. So it's kind of a small world that you mentioned that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And so are you – I know you're a numbers guy, like you're an analytical mind and a smart one at that. Do you like the film study? Do you like breaking down film? Where do you stand? Because football more than anything else. I mean, you can learn basketball, baseball, all that stuff. Where are you on like watching the games and watching film?
It's a little controversial, but I'll say I don't think you really need to watch the games. Because when you do, you can sometimes – add emotion to it. You can add I guess the way a game's going, like there's some context that gets lost when you only look at statistics or a scoreboard after the game. So looking at like how things actually happened is important, but I don't know if it's a necessary be-all to learn how players are performing and where to go for the next week, as far as like what kind of volume, like I'm targets and carries and opportunities drives everything for me with fantasy football. Having that opportunity is what makes you a valuable player, not in my eyes. And sometimes context is needed. Like, okay, this guy kept getting stuffed at the goal. He kept getting stuffed on every run he ran for. Why was that? It's because they decided to overload the box with 8 or 9 players each time. But that's something you can look up after the fact. You don't necessarily need to watch the game film to learn that. There's different resources available for that information. But so it's kind of a wishy-washy answer, but I'll say you don't need to watch it.
Yeah, I'm directly opposite. You have to watch it, but I don't like the – non-watch football different than other sports. Like I think baseball is 100% everybody's going to get equal opportunity and what they do. And yes, you could find fastball and curveball usage and, you know, those kinds of things. Football, I think, is very contextualized. It's very much like the thing with pass catching running backs, for instance, right? And I'll argue this all the time, is that I don't think enough people realize there is not a coach in the NFL, there's not a playbook written that says, I want to throw the ball to the running back. Like, that's not what they want to do. That's what they settle for. It's what the coverage will dictate. But it's never the idea, especially in these newer offenses, spread offenses where they want to attack. They don't want to just dump it off in the shortest possible, because
think about the success rate. It's much easier just getting direct to that guy than to having to dump it off and then worry about, you know, where these linebackers and safeties are at a given time. So when there's a certain element to it where I'm a big proponent of watching the games and seeing the context and all that. And it doesn't mean you have to sit on your couch on a Sunday and do it, but, you know, seeing what's going on. Same with corners, because that's another thing with corners is like, I don't believe in a shutdown corner. Like, I don't believe it exists. I think it's just, it's all fake news. Oh God, I hate using that term. But anyway, you know, what have I just done? You know what I mean? Like, because if you throw at a corner, like a good quarterback wide receiver relationship is going to beat the best cornerback in the universe 9 times out of 10, or 8 times out of 10. It should. The only times it doesn't is when, you know, they jump the route or the ball's misfired. It's thrown in a bad spot. The receiver runs a too loopy a route, doesn't cut it off quick enough. You know what I mean? Those little fundamental mistakes is what lead. And then the corner breaks up and then they get a good rating. And then what happens when you're Aqib Talib or Darrell Revis, they stop throwing at you. And once you have that designation, hey, I'm the shutdown corner, and they're not throwing at you, you got it made, because you don't have to break up as many passes. You know, you're not on your heels as much. But so that's where I think we gain some from film study, you know what I mean, and learning. I don't think it's all there. I think, you know, it's a mixture of both angles. You know, so that's sort of my thought. What do you think about that?
Well, I definitely agree with the cornerbacks being at an immediate disadvantage. A good quarterback receiver pairing should win 9 times out of 10, like you said. The defender is always trailing, and they don't always, but whenever their back is to the quarterback, it's game over. That receiver should win that catch 100% of the time. And then you get these gambling cornerbacks that, like, Asante Samuel always comes to mind, where he'll just like sit on a route or sit in a zone where he won't move, but he'll just pick off. He'll end up with like 6 to 8 interceptions in a year. That doesn't mean he was a good cornerback that year. That just means he gambled a ton. Marcus Peters was a good example for that with the Chiefs prior to going to the Rams. I haven't watched a ton of him yet this offseason to analyze how he's done. But those gambling types of cornerbacks, the guys that end up with a lot of interceptions aren't always the best players. They're just big gamblers.
100% true. And you're right. Marcus Peters is 100% in that. And back in his Kansas City days, and we saw when Talib went down in LA last year, this guy was atrocious to the point that smarter offensive coordinators said, all right, we're going at him. Not only are we not, you know, just sort of take what the offense gives you, now or what the defense gives, we're going at him directly. And he had never, you know, he haven't experienced that because he got a couple early, big interception years. I think he had 10, one, you know, first or second.
He had a boatload with the Chiefs, yeah.
Yeah, so, and then people said, all right, we're not going to go against them because of the turnover factor. But, yeah, there's a lot to that. And is there a tougher position in all of sports than cornerback? I think about it.
Probably the quarterback position.
Well, yeah.
If we're being honest.
True. Well, I think quarterback's more important. But I think that I played quarterback my entire life, so I love talking from that point of view. The one thing about a quarterback is you control your own destiny, at least, which I don't know about other people, but I always favored that. I always felt like I could be aggressive and I could assert myself where I want it, how I want it, whereas as a cornerback, man, because I also, sophomore year of high school, when they demoted me from quarterback and they tried to make me a wideout, then they tried to make me a defensive back, and I'm a big, goofy ox. I can't run. I never felt so scared my entire life. I thought, I don't know what's about to happen. I knew the routes, but I didn't know how to defend them. And I would, you know, only thing I had is knock it into people. I had nothing going for me. So I felt helpless as a corner. It could just be me, but like I always talk about this, Tyler, like, well, you know, you're playing in the neighborhood, right? Growing up, I don't know if you did this play, but when we played football, like what we do is just like, all right, wide receiver, go out. I'd be quarterback a lot. And if he's on your left shoulder, you run inside. If he's on your right shoulder, you go outside. That was just the de facto play all the time. And it, you know, when me and Schuster's big and slow and everything, but all we did that simple play, nobody could ever stop us. As long as the ball was delivered where it's supposed to be, they couldn't really do anything to us unless they jumped it, you know? And That's where I feel like corner, you're just screwed. Like if you get Peyton Manning or Tom Brady on, you know, and Tom Brady and Julian Edelman, good luck. I don't care who you're at, you know?
Yeah, that's why I'm not surprised at all when these, like, experienced quarterbacks go after the rookies, like, early in the season, just to see what they have. Can they defend a pass on an out route? Can they defend a post, a comeback? A lot of the time the answer is, yeah, but they're a step behind. And that mm-hmm. step behind is all a receiver needs now at the NFL level to make that completion.
Yeah, and certain, you know, certain corners do better at certain routes as well. I remember, I mean, the Dolphins corner, Xavier Rhodes of the Vikings, two of the better corners in the league right now. Even Dre Kirkpatrick from the Bengals. Like, these are guys that their rookie year, I was attacking in DFS. Attacking them because opponents, the you know, other offenses were doing the same. Eventually, they had some success and got the experience and got the respect of other quarterbacks, and then they started going away from them, and now they're amongst the better-rated corners in the league. So it's always fascinating. They will attack the rookies, though, and all DFS players need to know that. Don't worry about where they're drafted and how high they were, how good they were in college. They're going to get thrown on at the NFL level, and if they get thrown on, it's a volume. It's math at that point. You know, I'll take a guy who gets 7 targets against versus 3. I'll take the 7 targets and see what happens, even if it's a superior athlete. Now, so we're sitting here. So you got, you know, now you're with us here at Fantasy Guru. How's it been? And by no means do you have to say it's been pleasant. Have you anything surprised you? You're about a month into it at this point. Surprises, things that you weren't sure about, or what's your takeaways been so far?
It's been a dream come true, to be honest. I've been able to wake up whenever I want, get started, bust out 2 to 3 articles a day. I can write at my own pace. You guys have timelines for me, but I've always finished before that. So I have time to go to the gym. I have time to go to the grocery store. I have time to do extra research into the article I'm working on. There's so many perks where it's not like I have to like get up and get ready for the next job. I don't have to meal prep. I don't have to do all these kinds of little things that add up and waste a bunch of time. That's been the biggest change, is just the lifestyle of being able to work from home and do work at my own pace. I've been fortunate where I kind of operate at a quick pace where I normally, by the time I submit an article idea to you, I've already got the structure of it laid out in my head. So it's just kind of filling in the paragraphs, filling in the major points of emphasis, and building a strong argument for or against whatever the topic is.
I've encountered a lot of people in this industry over 15 years now, 14, 15 years, whatever it's been. And I've had a pretty good track record of people that I just believe in and I know are going to do great work. And dude, when you and I started talking, months ago about this opportunity and bringing you on and stuff, I knew it. And you just have that. And I think all the users out there and people that are subs at Fantasy Guru and Elite Fantasy will get that too. Certain people that when they get, you know, they like we break them full time or something like that, and then they'll just like, oh, now it's time to chill and relax. Dude, you're the exact opposite. Like, Tyler's on it. He has all these ideas. He's rolling through it. He has them developed. He knows solutions, you know, and I love to hear the fact this job should be fun. It should be more relaxed. Like you said, go to the store, set up your day how you set it up. But then you get that extra time, that extra little half hour, hour, 2 hours, whatever you need to polish off the idea that you have in your head. And I think that, you know, we're at the tip of the iceberg, man. You're going to be a star in this industry. And it's really exciting to watch. And I think the subs are going to love it for sure. And, I appreciate it. That's for sure. It's been a blessing. And you're the first, I think you're the first person that, in our entire company. Ray Flowers is definitely organized, but Tyler's as organized as anybody. And I am a crazy organized individual. And Tyler's like, dude, you got all your days planned out. You get your week, you know what you're doing. You're setting it up. You know, your timelines. That's rare in this industry too. You always been that way?
Yeah, I've always been a super organized person. It's just come with growing up, but it's just been a habit. And, it's not going to change for me. Like by the time Saturday comes around, I already know exactly each article I want to do for the following week. And I lay it out to you. You give me any feedback. Maybe we should do this. Maybe we should do that. Tweak this here and there. And by the time Monday morning comes around, I'm ready to rock and roll and bust these articles out for you.
Yeah, man. And I appreciate that greatly as well. What did you think? Now, we had the one of the funniest things that happened, we announced Tyler as part of the Elite Mafia and, you know, newest member of Fantasy Guru and full-time, all that good stuff. And then immediately, like, Samson of DFS Truth comes in and says, well, and he ripped on me for calling you one of the sharpest guys in the industry. And he goes, you've never said that previously. Like, for one, you don't know. I've talked to Tyler for a good amount of time thus far. Yes, I probably have not referred to him as one of the sharpest guys before he joined us. And I mean, I hope people realize how business works. I mean, why, you know what I mean? Like, I'll tout good work, don't get me wrong, but I'm also not going to hype other people's articles necessarily. You know, I mean, I think people get that at this point. What was your takeaway? That was like, welcome to the Mafia, Tyler, officially, because I warned you months ago, like, it was going to happen. We wear the black hats to a lot of fellow industry people. Have you been surprised, or were you surprised by Samson coming in right away?
Yeah, kind of off the bat, it didn't. I was not expecting it, but I'll say I've got thick skin. I'm not really worried about what someone says. I think he quoted how poorly I did in Millie Maker entries, one of the least profitable tournaments for you to jump in.
It's the worst. I tell people on national radio every day, and I play one entry every single week in the Millie Maker. It is the dumbest thing I do on a regular basis. It, besides, like, eat copious amounts of meat. Like, it's dumb. We all know it, but it's a dream, and it's fine. I guarantee you, though, if you start, and my wife will do this sometimes, if the DFS money ain't where it's supposed to be, she'll be like, you know, like almost like a, you know, like a mobster. She comes to me and is like, oh, your envelope feels a little light this month. The first thing I cut out is the damn Millie Maker. Like, anybody who's playing that is ridiculous. If you're playing that to profit, you're out of your mind. It's like scratching off a lottery ticket. You're simply, it's not an investment technique, folks. It's idiotic. We all know that. So I'm fascinated with the people that judge based on the Millie Maker or like one other massive GPP contest. Like, that's not the true test of whether somebody's profitable or not, or even more importantly, whether they're useful or not, or a good analyst or not. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely. Like I said at the beginning of the show, I'm mostly a single and three max entry kind of player. So if I'm feeling good about the lineup, I'll throw $20 on it. But most of the time, I'm normally spending that in like a $100 single entry. That's kind of my go-to wheelhouse, where I feel like that's where I kind of can get an edge playing the best lineup that I think can beat everybody with like one or two contrarian plays. You don't need to go off the wall in the smaller field tournaments. That's just kind of been my niche so far the last couple of years.
Our guy, Kevin Adams, here at the Elite Sports Network said years ago, like 3-4 years ago, one of the smartest things I've ever heard. He goes, there are no difficulty points. Like, there is no, you don't get bonus points. You may get like street cred or something else. That's fine. But when you want to deal with monetary dollars and cents and pluses and minuses, there's no difficulty points. Pulling a rabbit out of your hat or your backside doesn't really mean anything when there's a much smarter, safer play out there. So, you know, just something for everybody out there listening. Always take that into account. We're talking to Tyler Beaker. Meet Tyler Beaker, part of the Meet the Fantasy Guru team. And I'm pumped up, man. What do you think so far of the content we're rolling out? Are you surprised? Anything that shocks you? Any fan interaction that people put you, you know, asking you questions? Anything that's been interesting or surprising your first month there?
I really love the team here. A lot, group of great writers here with Armando, Russ, Taylor, Vlad, and everybody else. I think we got a really strong group here, and I can't wait for us to get like into the actual in-season content. I can't really wait for August when this stuff starts to ramp up. The draft guide's been a lot of fun to work on. I'll say that. That was something I wasn't expecting to have as much fun doing. But Taylor and I got together. We put together the best ball draft guide, basically where to play, roster construction, players to target, fade, that kind of thing. Basically just the how-to of how to approach best ball. And that was a lot of, that was a blast putting that together. That was our first thing that we debuted on the site. And it's fun seeing the things as we're getting into the summer, hitting all our benchmarks. This week I have an ADP report coming up. I think I'm going to focus on one site a week, basically seeing where players are climbing and falling and whether or not they're grabs or values or how you should pursue them, basically. And that's been an interesting thing so far. Another part has been the interaction with some of the articles I put out. One of them specifically was the Friday Fantasy Focus, which if you haven't read yet, it's an article that I'm trying to do every Friday where I take like a zoomed in look at a player and look at like their team outlook, kind of volume you can expect from them, what kind of role they have in the offense, what kind of changes the team made over the offseason, and whether or not you should be buying at current ADP. And the first guy was Curtis Samuel. It's kind of interesting doing that analysis, diving so far deep into just one specific player. That's been my favorite part so far. And a couple of readers reached out to me saying, wow, never thought of it that way. Or I'm with you on the expected projected targets for him. Didn't actually believe it until I saw you go through the exercise. And that was kind of cool just to get that interaction with some of the readers already.
What was the Curtis Samuel, like the end game of that? What did you feel? Is how reliant is everything on Cam Newton's shoulder?
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, Cam's been a top five fantasy quarterback in every year where he's played 16 games. The dude's unbelievable with his rushing upside. And the thing with Curtis, though, is the Curtis Samuel is the target volume. He's going to be possibly third on the team in target share behind Christian McCaffrey, DJ Moore. DJ Moore is running those shorter underneath targets. He has a lower ADOT. Christian McCaffrey also falls in that same boat. So we're going to see Curtis Samuel take a lot of those targets that are left over from Devin Funchess, and where he's running some more vertical routes. We'll see him do end arounds. But I really worry about week to week consistency with Curtis Samuel. He'll have the explosive 25 plus fantasy point outings, but they're not going to be on a weekly occurrence. And that's why I think Samuel's a much better fit for best ball leagues and as a buy right now in dynasty leagues.
And I'll say this with Cam Newton, you know, talking about his legs and how it affects the receivers. It's again, just simple math where the more yards you pick up, the more first downs you're generating, the more plays you're running, that equals more targets, which equals more receptions, your yards, touchdowns, all that. So rushing quarterbacks help their receivers in that regard too, just by extending the plays and making the offense more dynamic. If obviously they're doing it well and they're doing it, you know, and able to capitalize on it and not just running for their lives out of bad, you know, bad offensive line play. And then the other thing with McCaffrey is like, Matt, when Cam's shoulder got hurt, and I can't remember the week, I remember watching the game and said, he's toast. It is just 3 weeks before he went on IR. I said, this guy can't throw the football. I'm bringing everybody in. So all he did is dump off those passes to McCaffrey. So it will be fascinating if and when shoulder's fine, pushing the ball downfield, you know, Samuel could get a big uptick there. DJ Moore might get an uptick. And Greg Olsen, we could see hopefully a better season out of him there as well. What were you saying?
Oh, absolutely. I was reading some minicamp reports prior to recording this, and the Panthers have elevated him to doing intermediate to deep throws during the past week. So I think we're almost fully there with Cam Newton. He's a guy that I'm super high on because he, like I said, when he plays 16 games, he has historically finished in the top five as a fantasy option. And I think he's currently going maybe like QB 10, 12. Great buy for me at this current juncture.
I'm a big Cam guy all the time for the reasons you mentioned there. One other quarterback. Let's finish up on this one. Kyler Murray. You and I, buddy, we are on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to Kyler. You know, I'll get into my side a little bit. So you're very much pro Kyler Murray. Explain to the folks what you see in this kid that you think he could be very prolific or stable, at least in year one.
All right. Well, I'll say that I started an article last week called Smash Kyler Murray Prop Bets While You Can. So this is obviously why we're bringing this up here, because we are on two different sides of the fence. Murray, though, I think he's an identical prospect almost to Baker Mayfield. Mayfield had a little better accuracy in terms of like the adjusted completion rate, deep throws, that kind of thing. But like almost pass for pass, they were very similar in terms of completion percentage, adjusted yards per attempt. Murray set the NCAA record at 13.0. The year before that, Kyler Murray just did it at 12.9. So, like, these two guys are highly efficient quarterbacks. And, I mean, Murray just ran for 1,000 yards on the ground. Like, he is one of just two quarterbacks to throw for 4,000-plus passing yards and run for 1,000 rushing yards in the same season. The only other guy that's done that is Deshaun Watson. I'm fully on board with this guy. They're going to be in an air raid offense with Cliff Kingsbury. They're going to be throwing a ton. This offensive line is not fantastic whatsoever. That's one thing that people love to throw back as an argument against Murray. That's fine. He can get out on the run and pass well. Cliff Kingsbury's teams at Texas Tech never really were top shelf offensive lines, and his offense is still produced. I'm not really worried about this. Their defense, they're going to be without Patrick Peterson for the first 8 games. Negative game script could be a very big boon for him as far as them having be forced to pass in the second half of games. But I'm buying his passing yards props, his passing touchdown props, and his offensive rookie of the year props as well.
And now I'll throw water on it. Here's my side. Here's the thing. And the offensive lines, I actually like the I think the fact that Peterson's going down and that the game scripts are going to go in his favor. So I think that's a good thing. My problem with Kyler Murray, it starts at Cliff Kingsbury. Air raid offense, it sounds fantastic. And then why did he get S-canned from Texas Tech? Because his defense is stuck. It doesn't develop winning football. And that's a problem. And at the NFL level, you could throw out all the random receivers you want. You don't have time to throw the ball, and the game is just so fast. Playing in the Big 12 versus the NFL, it's not even the same. It's like me playing Lombard Falcon versus, you know, playing in the NFC West. It's just a different vibe. And Kyler Murray was big play reliant. And at 4,361, those yardage, out of those, 1,860 of those yards were on plays of 40 yards or more. 41.6% of his passing yardage came on big plays like that. That it simply doesn't happen no matter what offense you're in at the National Football League. The game's too fast. Corners are too good. Safeties are too good. You don't have the time. I always use the basic logic, like, how long does it take a receiver to run 40 yards? You know, even if you're Marquise Brown, it takes you 4.3 seconds. How many chances do you think Murray's going to have 4.3 seconds to throw the football? Based on last year, you're looking at about 6% of the time. And even if they upgrade a little bit, which they did with Marcus Gilbert at tackle, you know, we'll say it upgrades a little bit. Let's say he gets a nice 3 seconds to throw a football. It's going to be real difficult to complete 1,800 yards worth of 40-yard-plus passes. So, and then rushing, 650 of his 1,001 yards came on 19 yards or longer runs, 64.9%. Again, quarterbacks that run that much and run for that long, you just don't get – unless you're Cam Newton, you're 6'5", 260, you don't really get the opportunity to run over people and around people very often. So that's why I'm nervous. And the more he runs, the more injury-prone he is with rushing quarterbacks. That's always the case, unless you're Cam or even Deshaun Watson is pretty big. Something we learned back in Michael Vick era, Tyler, because I was a Vick rushing quarterback guy too. From back in the day, but then he constantly got hurt and I had to say, all right, stay away. So that's why I'm throwing some cold water on it. I like the kid though. I think there's a lot of, you know, comparisons, obviously to Baker makes that sense. A lot of comparisons to Russell Wilson, undersized quarterbacks. Also there's a leverage there. I think because of the offense, he's not going to be your standard, you know, 5 to 7 foot, 7 step drop guy. And they're going to flush him out of the pocket, you know, do some things creatively to help him get better passing windows. So that's good. So I'll put that as just even though he's undersized. So that's why. And rookie quarterbacks, even when you're Peyton Manning and Tom Brady and all the best in the world, just don't generally, put up, you know, 4,300 plus passing yards and all that. So those are the reasons that I'm out on Kyler Murray, at least for this year. In a dynasty format, I'm a little more bullish on him. But your thoughts on that?
Yeah, a strong argument. I think one thing that I definitely see as far as like his like ability to make big plays downfield, I think Andy Isabella will be a welcome addition to that offense, where I viewed him very similarly as a Brandon Cooks-esque receiver with his big playability downfield at UMass. He was one of the most proficient receivers, I think, as far as operating out of the slot and getting deep passes per PFF, if I'm not mistaken that. He also has Hakeem Butler, 6'5", great bailout guy. Larry Fitzgerald's huge, still operating out of the slot. Christian Kirk, I mean, David Johnson has a check down option. There's just so many ways for them to attack and rotate their receivers. I love the versatility of these guys because there's so many receivers here that can operate in the slot, outside. And it's just going to give Kingsbury a bunch of different options of how to use these guys and create mismatches. It's really funny because I was trying to look up more information on this team through minicamp, and they've like hushed the media. They're like not letting them leak things out about this offense. They're not showing them any kind of offensive plays. We're going to see just vanilla plays during the preseason as well. We're not really going to see what kind of effect Kingsbury's offense will really have until week one here. So it's a lot of intrigue entering the offseason, and it's definitely going to be a talking point where we're going to hear a lot of pros and cons leading up to week one.
Yeah, it'll be a talking point for us for absolute sure. The Kyler Murray debate will rage on as we go, and it's not the end of it, that's for sure. I do think, though, that Isabella stuff is very interesting because if Kyler does well and starts all 16 games, you have to take one of his receivers away, whether it's Kirk, Isabella, you know, one of these guys, even Hakeem Butler, is going to have to be getting those deep balls and those big plays, and that could lead to great DFS weeks. It could lead to great seasonal weeks there as well. All right, that's going to do it for us, everybody. The Meet Tyler Beaker podcast. It is in the books. I hope you guys had fun meeting Tyler like I have, and we look for great things to come. Tyler, any final words from you, my friend?
I'm just really excited to get into things here with the Fantasy Guru and the Elite Fantasy brand. I really appreciate the opportunity to write for here. If you guys have any kind of questions or anything, I try to pop into the chat at least once or twice a day. Becoming active more and more there. Feel free to offer any kind of suggestions for a Friday fantasy focus, perhaps on a player that you're kind of on the fence about. This week I'm looking at doing one into Rashad Penny. He's someone that I've kind of been a little bit more interested in with the Chris Carson being sidelined now due to injury. I want to see what kind of outlook he has entering the 2019 season. But yeah, excited to be on board and look forward to interacting with all the different readers and getting to know everyone.
Absolutely, man. So for Tyler Beaker, remember, guys, give him some guys. Who do you want to be focused on the Friday Fantasy Focus player profile? Check him out there as well. For Tyler Beaker, this is Jeff Manns. See you next time, everybody. Deuces.